ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 9, text number 20.
Got 20 on the board?
Yes?
Okay.
Yum. The person. Oh, we're doing okay. We'll just go through the Sanskrit. Yum. Manyase. Matulayam, Priyam, Mitram, Suratamam, Akaro, Sachivam, Tutam, Soradat, Atha, Saratim, Yamanyase matuleyam Priyam mitram suratamam Akaro sachivam dutam Soradad atasaratim Yamanyase matuleyam Priyam mitram suratamam Akaro sachivam dutam Soradad atasaratim Yamanyase matuleyam Priyam mitram suratamam Akaro sachivam dutam Soradad atasaratim Please chant. Ladies, please.
Yamanyase matuleyam.
Yam, the person. Manyase, you think. Matuleyam, maternal cousin. Priyam, very dear. Mitram, friend. Surettamam, ardent, well-wisher, sorry. Akarom, executed. Sachivam, counsel. Dutam, messenger. Sodadat, by good will. Ata, thereupon. Saratim, charioteer. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, He, O King. Now, who's speaking? Bhishma Dev is speaking. He's lying on a bed of arrows, and he's on the way to dying. And so, presently, he is giving some counsel, some guidance, and direction to especially King Yudhisthira, but all the Pandavas in general. And he's enjoying very much looking at them, because they are his grandsons. Would someone like to volunteer and explain how they are his grandsons, by what relationships? If you don't know, it's okay, by the way, because it took me a few minutes before to figure it out. Anybody know how they become the grandsons? I hope I can remember. They become the grandsons by virtue of the fact that King Pandu was born from Vyasadeva, and I believe either Ambalika or Ambika. So Vyasadeva is the actual grandfather of the Pandavas, okay? Because they are the sons of Pandu. But Bhishma Dev is a half-brother of Vyasadeva, okay? He's a half-brother. Therefore, they, in effect, become sort of half-grandsons, although they're not referred to as that, but they are grandsons in that respect. Vyasadeva is their actual grandfather, and Bhishma Dev is sort of a partial grandfather by virtue of the fact that Vyasadeva and Bhishma Dev are half-brothers because they have a common father, Shantanu. What? No. I made a mistake? Oh, okay, because you went like this, so I thought maybe I did. I do make mistakes. Huh? I can't hear you, Father. It's Vyasadeva's father, that's correct. But, yeah, I know. What is that?
They have a legal relationship, but they don't have a common father, because Vishmadev's father was Maharaj Shantanu, whereas Vyasadeva's father is Parashara Muni with Satyavati. So they don't have a biological
so common
father.
So what is the common
Well, so it's like a, you know, in-law.
Huh?
He was a grandfather-in-law.
Grandfather's-in-laws, okay. So, getting into the translation now, that, O King, that personality whom out of ignorance... Also, thank you for the correction. Appreciate that. O King, that personality whom, out of ignorance only, you thought to be your maternal cousin, your very dear friend, well-wisher, counselor, messenger, benefactor, etc., is that very personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. Purport. Lord Sri Krishna, although acting as the cousin, brother, friend, well-wisher, counselor, messenger, benefactor, etc. of the Pandavas, was still the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, he does not change his position despite these different relationships. He was still the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Out of his causeless mercy and favor upon his unalloyed devotees, he performs all kinds of service, But that does not mean that he has changed his position as the absolute person. To think of him as an ordinary man is the grossest type of ignorance and even offense. But on the other hand, he often appears like an ordinary person and deliberately tries to act like an ordinary person, especially when he's with the Pandavas. But in effect, he remains always the Supreme Personality of Godhead and can manifest that at any given time. Omagyana timarandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshur unmuditam yena tasmai shri guruve namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto his lotus feet. So here we have in the translation, Bhishma Dev is mentioning to the Pandavas that personality whom out of ignorance only you thought to be your maternal cousin, your very dear friend, your well-wisher, counselor, messenger, benefactor, etc., is that very personality of Godhead, Krishna. What he's implying here is that there is a tendency when we are with a very great, very glorious, very wonderful person, when we first meet with them, there is a sense of reverence and a sense of awe and a sense of glory and a sense of greatness. But as we become more and more familiar with this person, we talk to him or her more and more daily, that sense of wonder, that sense of glory, sometimes is forgotten. It doesn't mean that we don't think he's glorious, but we forget it because in the conversation of daily parlance, there's a tendency to just speak in an easygoing, familiar, friendly manner. So this is what Bhishma Dev is remarking on. It's so easy to forget that that personality, who's all those things which I have been mentioning, is actually the Supreme Lord. How easy to forget. And that goes for all of them. However, Krishna, what he wants to, can also remind them of who he is when he wants to do that. When he wants to simply relate to them as a friend, he doesn't want them thinking of him as a great Lord. He wants them to simply act as they normally would to a friend. And that's pretty much the way that happens. When they first meet, if they've been away, well then of course Krishna himself pays his obeisances to Yudhisthira because Yudhisthira is older. And then Bhima, he also pays his obeisances because he's older. And Arjuna embraces him because they are basically the same age. And then the twins, Nakula and Sahadev, they offer obeisances. This is the proper etiquette. But when the conversations get going, that etiquette slowly fades out and they basically talk to each other as friends. So Bhishma Dev is mentioning how, basically he's saying how easy it is to be forgetful of the Lord. Even though we're hearing this now, even though we'll be reading about this possibly when we go back or this evening, similarly we forget that the Lord is everywhere in every atom of creation. How often during the day are we conscious of the fact that Krishna is there and there in the light bulb, in the railing there, in this Tulsi holder. We forget this and we see them as ordinary things, so to speak. The tree is a tree and that's it. It's just a tree. It has leaves. It has leaves. It has flowers. It has flowers. So we don't think that this is a tree which is being held together by the Supreme Lord. The Absolute Truth is within that tree. And within that tree is also a living entity that is deriving its existence from the absolute truth, the super soul within. So these are the things that we forget, but a Mahabhagavat does not forget. This is what we have to understand, what we have to realize, and have to know how we differ from the Mahabhagavat. The Mahabhagavat sees God everywhere, anywhere. And if he does, or she does forget the Lord for a few seconds, notwithstanding, he corrects himself. Oh, my Lord, I forgot you. How horrible. What a wretched person I am to forget the most important, the most valuable, the most great, lovable person that there is, and I forgot you. Look how materialistic I am. If for 3 seconds he was materialistic and he's condemning himself. But that's the right attitude, really. That's how much he values. That's how much he cherishes. That's how much he treasures the Lord and feels he should remind himself to never, never, ever, ever forget Krishna, where and when possible. Sometimes that could even be impossible due to the nature of one's activities, one's work, what one may have to do. You're on a computer and you're doing some important calculation and you have to finish that. So you can't always be thinking of Krishna. But when the opportunity comes, that's the time one should shift into, just as we normally do when we drive a car, we shift into drive and start moving along. So when we shift into Krishna gear, then we remember Krishna while we're looking at the tree or looking at the street or looking at the car or looking at the form of a devotee or looking at this cushion. Whatever it is, Krishna is within it. Krishna's form is there, but we may be blind to seeing that. Nonetheless, as we become more and more conscious of the fact that we must remember Krishna, and ideally remember Krishna lovingly, remember Krishna gratefully, remember Krishna with a sense of complete appreciation, that we have gotten the opportunity to have these books, to read these books, to know what we should do. Look at how the whole... What? Get it closer? Yeah? Okay. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. So we have to we have to keep this in mind that if we want to become truly like a Mahabhagavat who not only remembers Krishna, but actually when he wants to, can see Krishna anywhere and everywhere. Krishna is there. It's simply a matter of determination or a matter of desire. Because, as I said, if your mind is on something in particular, then you may not want to be seeing Krishna at that time. But if the time allows and the situation allows, then one can. Because that is his or her chief love. When you love someone, you just want to always be with that someone. And that's what I'm going to get into right now in this particular verse. Let me get into the purport. So here we see different relationships that Krishna has with with the five Pandavas. And now this is really dealing with rasa. Rasa means relationship that one has. As Bhakti Charu Maharaj mentioned a few days ago, that there are basically five chief rasas. First rasa, that is often referred to as neutrality or peacefulness. There is no intimate, what we call, relationship. One has a sense of awe, a sense of reverence, a sense of the Lord's greatness, and in that state we progress by always trying to remember the wonderful, masterful, glorious qualities that the Lord has. And in so doing, we too gradually, slowly develop those qualities by the grace of Krishna. So this is the first, and this is what we need to always be thinking. There's a tendency on all of us, since we came into this material world, to be lords, to be important, to be dominators, to be controllers. The result is that we tend to forget who Krishna truly is, that we can never be equal to him. And so at times we try to be equal, we try to be a lord, we try to be important, we try to be prominent. And all this is, of course, is trying to compete with the Lord. It doesn't mean that one cannot become expert, prominent, able, but it means that it's done with a true sense that whatever I am manifesting, whatever is great in me, whatever is glorious in me, is coming by the grace of the Supreme Lord. I did not get it by simply chanting. I did not get it by simply worshiping. I did not get it by simply praying. Ultimately, it came by Krishna's grace. Grace is a gift, an undeserved gift, okay? Undeserved because no matter how much we do, we can never equal what Krishna has done for us. What he has done for us is so magnificent and magnanimous that all we can do is always feel that, yes, this has come from the grace of God or the mercy of God. And when we have that attitude, then we are prevented from being very proud, very self-loving, self-glorious, self-applauding. This quality of self-love or false pride is the killer of just about every devotee I know. Every sannyasi has fallen down because of pride. Indra, the chief of the gods, fell down because of pride. What is this strangling weed? It means that, as I've already said, we came into this world to be a lord. And as soon as we get the opportunity, we jump to it. We grab it, and we try to expand it, and that's the problem. We forget that we are just insignificant, living, small, tiny souls, part and parcel of the gigantic, wonderful, amazing Supreme Soul. When we keep that consciousness that we are small, we are tiny, insignificant, not at all important, no matter how many people may be applauding us and praising us and honoring us and celebrating us, inwardly we reject all that and put it on the lotus feet of our spiritual master, number one, and then it goes from the spiritual master to the supreme master, Krishna, who owns it all because he is all-powerful, all-knowing. He owns everything in this world. There is nothing that is not his. There is no particular power that is not his. As he said, he's omnipotent, he's omniscient, omnipresent. So once we hold that consciousness and not forget it, and not think that, yes, I'm important, I'm great, I'm glorious, I'm wonderful, I'm I, and then there goes Krishna out the window. That has to not happen. And it only will not happen by continuous reminding ourselves of who we are, what our position is, and where we have to go to achieve the highest position, which is pure love of Krishna. Pure love of Krishna means there's never a moment that you don't think of him or you don't want to think of him. And you feel such joy, such pleasure, such satisfaction in the course of such thinking. When two people love one another, that's all they do is think about one another. And as it's mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, if one of them dies, then the other can't go on living because the love is so strong that it's as if his life or her life has been removed when the beloved has disappeared. So our feeling should be, when we wake up in the morning, ah, another day, another wonderful day to serve my beloved Lord. He's feeding me. He's clothing me. He's sheltering me. He's guiding me. He's giving direction. He's giving me good health. He's giving me strength. Giving me intelligence. We have to remind ourselves all these which we have, which we use, are coming from the Supreme Lord Krishna. They didn't just get there. They didn't just jump into our bodies and minds. Krishna is the ultimate giver of these. So we should feel some sense of gratitude immediately. When we feel gratitude, what can I do to repay my beloved Lord? What can I do to say thank you? Nothing. There is nothing we can do except just keep trying. Because the amount of affection or love that we owe the Lord is inconceivable and infinite. Therefore, no matter how much we give, no matter how much we do, no matter how much we offer, we find ourselves still in great, tremendous debt. So if the debt is there, the devotee actually relishes that debt because it becomes an impetus or a motivation to go on trying to serve Krishna to a certain extent, as much as he can, and better than he is presently doing. So we try to improve our service, and we try to improve it under the influence of the Supreme Lord Krishna. So friendship is the chief or the predominating rasa that is present with the Pandavas and Krishna, and especially Arjuna. Remember, Arjuna and Krishna go back many, many thousands of years. They were Nara and Narayan. Narayan, of course, was Krishna, and Nara was his buddy. They were hermits. They lived in the forest, and Arjuna was empowered. He's an empowered incarnation at that point in time. That's what he manifested, the special powers that Krishna gave him. So, as I just said, that they are friends presently of Krishna. And as it was mentioned yesterday in Dhruta Karma's class, there are different kinds of friendship. There's little children friendship. When the kids, they play, they run after bird shadows, they play with monkeys' tails, they play they jump into ponds and they chase after bullfrogs, or they play bullfighting together. They play tag together. They play with sticks and they try to get the stick on each other's bodies, and whoever gets the stick on, he's the winner and he has to carry Krishna. And he gets on and he gets on Krishna's back, as it was mentioned, and he tells Krishna, come on, get going. This is the Supreme Lord of the universe. This is the one who's maintaining the whole universe. He creates it. He can destroy it. He's so powerful, and that's what makes it so funny. And that's why Krishna enjoys it. Here, these boys are actually thinking that he's weak, that he's not capable. He can't really fight as well as they can fight. Until push comes to shove, and we get a situation like the Bakasura shows up, and they all become very, very frightened, very fearful. This big, gigantic heron. You know, like a stork. So they wince and back off. But the heron grabs Krishna, swallows Krishna, and all the boys, the beloved is gone. How will he get out? He can't get out. He's just a little boy like us. We can't get out. He can't get out. But Krishna sees their groaning. He sees their how they're crying. How they're moaning. And they don't want this to happen because they love him so much. They want to be with him always. So Krishna makes the throat of Bakasura so hot, hotter and hotter, that he can't hold Krishna anymore. So he vomits him out. Down on the floor. And there is Krishna again. But Bakasura is raging. He's raging mad. And he's going to go for Krishna and try to swallow him again. And as he tries to do that, then Krishna grabs the beaks and he bifurcates them, pulls them apart. And the coward boys go, is that Krishna? Is that our little friend Krishna doing that? No, it can't be. Because that's not the way they know Krishna. So what happens is that he bifurcates Bakasura completely. Bakasura is dead. And then they're looking at Krishna, saying, something's wrong. This doesn't make sense. Because Krishna is our friend. He's our equal. We beat him up. We can't beat up Bakasura. They have this. So what Krishna does by an act of yoga maya, or the yoga maya is the illusory energy that Krishna has, and he can make his devotees think anything he wants to make them think, which will further his purpose in helping himself enjoy his particular pastime. So, as I said, we have these different pastimes that come. Now, it's mentioned here that Krishna is the well-wisher of Arjuna and all the Pandavas. And we have many different examples of that. One example that comes to my mind is when Yudhishthira wanted to be the emperor, and he would have to defeat Jarasandha in order to do that. So a fight was waged between Jarasandha and Bhima, Arjuna, and Krishna went to his country called Magadha, and they challenged him. In order for Yudhishthira to become the emperor, he would have to defeat the person who was considered to be the virtual emperor, because he had so many hundreds of kings locked up in a fortress that he was going to give them into a fire for sacrifice in order to gain more power. Krishna didn't like that. So, long story short, is that Bhima fought with Jarasandha. Remember, Bhima had the strength of 10,000 elephants. And Jarasandha also had the strength of 10,000 elephants. And I believe they fought for, if I may be wrong, 28 days. Am I right on that? Anybody remember exactly? Anyway, whatever it was, it's 28, 24. So they fought, and after the 28 days, Bhima said to Krishna there, he says, I can't defeat him. I can't beat him. He's too tough. He's too difficult. What am I going to do? He says, I'll give you a sign. I'll give you a symbol. So what happens? The fight resumed. And then Krishna took a leaf out of the ground, and he took it and he pulled it in half. He bifurcated the leaf. And then it gave Bhima the remembrance of the fact that Jarasandha was born in two parts. Yeah, it was two parts, like half a body. Half leg, a leg here, half her chest, half her head. So what happened is the parents took those two parts and threw them out in the trash. And a particular witch named Jara, she came by and she saw these two parts. And she looked at them and she decided that she would knit them together, put them together. So she put them together and did a few spells. And Jarasandha was one part. So she had a very great respect for the king and the queen. So she brought the new baby, who is now one part, not two parts. She says, here's your baby. Says, did you do that? Yes. Thank you very much. So Jarasandha had a weakness in his spine, where she had knitted it together by her magical spells. But nobody knew that. The only thing anybody knew was Jarasandha was an inconceivable fighter. Nobody could beat him, or very few, except Krishna, who beat him 17 times and would have beat him an 18th time, except that there was a summons from Rukmini, who wanted to marry him, and if he didn't come, then she would have to marry Shishupal. So he was known as the person who left the battlefield. There was a field. That's another matter. So anyway, what happened was that Bhima, in the fighting, took the leg of Jarasandha and pulled it all the way until he was in two pieces. He split him in half. And that was the end of Jarasandha. And then Krishna and Arjuna, Bhima could bring the good news back to Yudhishthira, that he could now do the Raja Surya sacrifice, because he would not have any interference from Jarasandha, and nobody would object. Of course, there were still other things that had to be done. So that is a very good example of Krishna being the well-wisher. It is also mentioned that Krishna is a counselor. Well, we see the whole Bhagavad Gita. He's doing nothing but counseling. He's advising Arjuna that you should do this, you should do that, you should not do this, you should not do this. And many, many instructions are being given actually for us. Arjuna was not ignorant at all. That was not his normal position. But through Yogamaya, he was given some ignorance at this time. How do we know that? Well, at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna says, "Now I am confused about my duty and have lost all composure due to miserly weakness. In this condition, I'm asking you to tell me for certain what is best for me. Now I am your disciple and a soul surrendered unto you. Please instruct me." Okay, so that's the instruction that is going on. At the end, on the 18th chapter, Krishna says, "Have you heard this with an attentive mind? Are your ignorance and illusions now dispelled?" So Arjuna says, "My ignorance is now gone. I have regained my memory by your grace. I am firm and free from doubt and am prepared to act according to your instruction." So there you are. At the beginning, he's confused, he's full of doubts, he's full of uncertainties, and now he knows exactly what he has to do, and of course he's going to do it. So, therefore, Krishna was the supreme counselor of the Pandavas, and it was by his counsel, and but even more so, his blessings, his grace, his love, that the Pandavas won the whole battle of Kukshetra, even though they were outnumbered 7-11. 11 million to 7 million. But it didn't matter, because Krishna was on the side of the Pandavas. He was the charioteer, and he was calling the shots for Arjuna. And at the end, there were only about three of the opposite side left, just all. And there were the five Pandavas, they were left. The three, of course, one was Ashvatthama, the other one was the warrior teacher. The name escapes my memory, but know it, he's the warrior. And then there was another one, I think the Vaish son of Dhritarashtra. Three left out of 11 million. So therefore, he gave good counsel. Krishna was also the messenger. When push came to shove, and it was clear that Duryodhana wanted a war, Krishna did not want a war, he wanted peace. So he went on behalf of the Pandavas and tried to explain how no one could benefit. Duryodhana was so dumb, so pig-headed, and so greedy that he said, "No, there has to be a war because I want to be the king. I have that position now and I'm going to keep it. That's it." So then what happened was that Krishna tried to negotiate a peace settlement. And still, they could not settle. They could not reach a conclusion, and the result was that there would have to be a war. But he tried very hard to negotiate this. So it's very easy to pull the trigger. It's very easy to throw the knife. But it's more difficult to show restraint, and Krishna was showing us by his example, don't be so eager to jump the gun. Better to take your time and try to work it out. And if you can work it out, so much the better. So fewer people get hurt, and so many people maintain their lives, and their lives go on, etc. Now, so Krishna was also, he was a messenger, as I just mentioned. He was a benefactor, that's mentioned also. Yes, when the Pandavas finally received, this comes earlier than what I was just speaking about. When the Pandavas come back from having been away for a year, it was decided by Bhishmadev and Vidura that it would not be useful for the Kurus to keep all the kingdom, but that they should give half to the Pandavas. So, therefore, they gave them half. But the half that they gave them was desert and jungle. They didn't get much. And they kept all the jewels, they kept the palaces, they kept the chariots, they kept everything that was of wealth, they kept it. The Pandavas had nothing. So what happened was that, of course, there was a burning of the Kandava forest. Once that was burned and the whole area had been made arable so that something could be built on it, Krishna, he was the benefactor, and that he called upon Vishvakarma. And he said to Vishvakarma, please build the Pandavas a tremendous, a beautiful, glorious palace, an assembly hall. And that's what he did. So Vishvakarma was acting under the instruction of Krishna, who was very, very, very sympathetic and very kind and loving. So what happened is that palace, that assembly house, was so beautiful that Duryodhana, again, he just wanted to kill the Pandavas and get that palace. This is greed. This is demoniac. So he was benefactor. Another thing is that it's mentioned that Arjuna was the brother of Krishna. Does anybody know that relationship? How he became the brother? You got to say it loud. Yes, go ahead, Prabhu. Huh? Married Subhadra. Yeah. Thank you. That's right. So by marrying Subhadra, who was Krishna's sister, therefore Arjuna became, in a sense, a half-brother of Krishna. Arjuna became a half-brother of Krishna by marrying Subhadra. So that was another thing that was there. So the important point of all of this is that by developing our relationship, right now our devotees ask me, well, what should we be doing? What is our rasa? Our rasa presently is a combination of awe and reverence, or peacefulness, and also servitorship. Being a servant, and being a loving servant, being a sweet servant, being a detached servant. You do something, don't expect anything in return. And if you get something in return, always consider it but to coming from Krishna and to belong to Krishna. And if we always think that we own nothing, we have nothing, like I say in that prayer often, my dear Lord Krishna, I have nothing except what you give me. I have nothing except what you give me. I know nothing except what you teach me. I do nothing except what you enable me. I accomplish nothing except what you arrange for me, and I want nothing except pure love of your lotus feet through pure devotional service, and if I have that, I will have everything. So that's all that's needed, pure love of Krishna's lotus feet. For that is what he appreciates most, that is what is most dear to him, that is what he loves greatest, and that is why he is showering upon the Pandavas his love, because they love him in an inextricable, inseparable fashion. And that's what we need to be aspiring after, even if we cannot come up to it at this time. And the way we do that is by performing our daily loving service and consciously always trying to remember Krishna, begging him, my Lord, I am so forgetful. I'm so worthless and useless. All I do is I keep forgetting you. Please help me to remember you. And when I remember you, help me to remember you with love. Help me to remember you with sweetness. Help me to remember you that in the sense that I owe you so much, but I can never repay it, but I still should try my best to repay it. And if I act in that manner, and if you show your mercy upon me, I will realize that this is a gift, 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 gift. Undeserved. And if we have that attitude, you can't get proud. There's no room for pride when you think that this all belongs to Krishna. It's only when we think we are the doer, we are the performer, we are the endeavorer, We're the one who made it happen. As soon as that mentality creeps in, we're dead spiritually, completely. So if we remember this particular point, all of us, no matter whether you're this on the status of or the totem pole of the temple echelon, if you're small, big, there is no big and there is no small. Those are relativities which we deal with in order that things can go on. But the reality is that Krishna sees us, shows his affection to us in accordance, as he says, as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. So to the extent that we surrender to Krishna, my body is yours, my mind is yours, my intelligence is yours, my properties are yours, all praise and honor and distinction and glorification, they're all yours. I am just nothing, servant of the 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 servant, and even farther back, because I am really nobody, I am nothing, but just please keep me engaged in your service. Hare Krishna. Okay, any questions or comments? Now I see a hand go up. Yes, you're gonna. Could you come a little closer? It's gonna be. Oh, okay. You got the mic. Good.
Oh, thank you, Maharaj. Your class.
Let's talk a little louder and into the mic, please. Thank you.
Thank you. I agree with everything you said, and your class is completely appreciated. Thank you very much. Completely enlightened. How can we find the balance between bona fide humility and unfavorable humility? Because we can understand one time Srila Prabhupada said...
What is a bona fide devotee?
Bona fide humility and unfavorable humility.
What do you mean by an unfavorable devotee?
Unfavorable humility. Bona fide humility and unfavorable humility. What Srila Prabhupada one time mentioned, what is the use of one being American if one cannot do something wonderful for Krishna?
Yeah.
So at the same time, there's unfavorable humility where one can fall into a state...
Okay, give me an example of an unfavorable devotee.
Not devotee, humility. Like one can fall...
Are you saying unfavorable humility?
Yes.
Sorry about that, because come over when it reached this side of the room.
Right.
It sounded different. So unfavorable humility?
Unhumility.
Well, okay, I'll mention and I'll explain.
And then there's favorable humility.
And unfavorable humility.
Yeah,
thank you. It's a very good question, by the way, because... As I said already, the tendency for all of us is to want to be a lord, a dictator, a dominator, a person who is a controller. All that is there. That's natural. It's a part of our being. It's when we come into this world, we learn it from the time we're children. So now, favorable humility is that's what's being... And what is unfavorable humility? When any humility is done for self-gratification, self-sense gratification, that's unfavorable because we're putting ourselves, our little false self, our body, as the center. As soon as we become the center and we put on a show, oh, thank you very much, oh, I can't thank you enough, you're so kind, you're so sweet, you're so loving, I throw myself at your feet, take my obeisances, but in effect you're doing it to be admired. You're doing it to be honored. You're doing it to be celebrated, not because you really mean what you say. And the very opposite is favorable humility. When you do it because you really love Krishna and you want Krishna to be glorified, you want Krishna to be honored, you want Krishna to be praised, you want Krishna to be served, and you want everyone to love Krishna, and if that's your predominating mood and feeling, that's real, that's true, that's infinite and eternal humility. Okay? Okay. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. All glories to Srila Prabhupada ki. Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Hare Krishna. Wait. Now.